Well, to make a long story short, he did get better. Not only did he get better, but his x-rays changed very dramatically. And Dr. Cousins went on to write about this experience in the New England Journal of Medicine, which was the first time that New England Journal of Medicine had ever written an article published by a non-MD. And now you know, of course, that Dr. Cousins is a dean at UCLA School of Medicine. That can happen only in California. But nevertheless, Dr. Cousins, I shouldn't make fun of this, made an enormous contribution to medicine because he showed that, in fact, laughter elicits healing. And when I mentioned this to the Vedic doctors, they said, yes, it's because of the sound that occurs when you laugh. It's the sound that heals, the sound of laughter. So here's the second sound here. Take a deep breath. Now, you have to be careful here in that you don't breathe in when you're on the hurt. It has to be on the exhalation. Not only that, it has to be a belly laughter. You should feel that sound bouncing off your belly. So see if you can bounce it off your belly. Excellent. So that's a healing sound too. Then there are some others here. You know, we won't go through all of these. Some here. The last one here is the sound of resonance. Resonance is also very important. You know, when people grow old, sometimes you say the voice becomes croaky. And these sounds, it's because the voice loses resonance. And the sound of resonance is also a healing sound. So it's the last sound here. Again, on the exhalation, you have the sound go through your sinus cavities and through your skull cavities also. You should feel the resonance there. Ma 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 ma. All on the exhalation. All on the exhalation. These are all also pranayama. Pranayama means breathing techniques. They open up your lungs because you're prolonging the exhalation phase, and then you take a deep breath and then you start all over again. Now sometimes you want to decrease the resonance also, balance the resonance with decreasing. So the opposite of the resonance sound is this second last sound. Ya yu ye, ya yu ye, ya yu ye, ya yu ye. Jaws. Ya yu ye, ya yu ye. That's right. Okay. And then the first one, you know, I wouldn't recommend all of these. Some of them are pretty complicated. They, in fact, take you through the entire range of musical frequencies, the musical note. But we won't do that now because it wouldn't be appropriate time. The first one is also quite good. Ka-ga-ha, 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 ka-ga-ha on the exhalation. It comes from here. Ka-ga-ha, 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 ka-ga-ha. You see these sounds come from different parts. Some of them are vocal sounds. Some of them are dental sounds. Some of them are labial sounds. Some of them are palatal sounds. And all these different sounds come from different parts from where we generate the sound. Ultimately, it's of course one field. We just create these different vibrations. So I think that's enough for sounds. All we know now is that we are beginning to see the results of this research. We're doing research with sounds on test tubes, but there's a scientist in Austin, Texas, a neurophysiologist that I met last week, and she showed some fascinating studies to me that she has been doing on the primordial sound techniques, on EEG, etc., and brainwave and blood flow to the brain, etc. And she's going to send me all this material, and then we are going to approach some medical institutions that are already interested in this form of healing. Because, I said earlier, UCLA and Stanford, there's a lot of work going on in the effect of sound and also on the effect of music. In Ayurveda, we use primordial sounds, both like we practice, then subtle sounds in consciousness, and then we also use music, and we also have other primordial sounds that we listen to. These are basically Vedic chants, but not for the meaning of it, just for the sound value of it. We listen to them with the eyes closed and with volume as low as possible. And we also have what is called Gandharva Ved music. Now I don't unfortunately have the music with me here today. I had planned to bring it, but then I didn't retrieve the memory at the appropriate time. So if you want, you could, if you want to know more about this Vedic music, the healing music, it's called Gandharva Ved music, and I can give you an 800 number that you can call and ask them if you want, you know, to buy those tapes. Or you could even call a local TM center here and they would help you get them. They're called Gandharva Veda music, G-A-N-D-H-A-R-V-A. It's the traditional healing music that we use, and it is supposed to, according to the Vedic literature, to synchronize your biological rhythms with cosmic rhythms. And I'll come to that in just one moment. And the number is 1-800-ALL-VEDA. All, A-L-L, dash, Veda, V-E-D-A. V as in victory, E as in enlightenment. D as in dance. And this music is different for different times of the day because our biological rhythms are tied into cosmological rhythms. There are four basic cosmological cosmic rhythms. One is as the earth moves on its own axis, we have the cycle of day and night. This causes what is called the circadian rhythm. And your body is completely different at 4 o'clock in the afternoon from 4 o'clock in the morning. And you know that. You feel that physiologically. You feel that in cycles of sleep and activity. But even moods change during the whole day because our bodies are changing. In mice, in some mice, you can give them a certain dose of radiation at 4 o'clock in the morning and it'll kill the mouse. If you give the same dose of radiation at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it has a beneficial effect. Now, this understanding in biology is becoming very important. It's leading to a whole new field in chemotherapy also, in cancer treatment, called chronobiology or chronotherapy. It means timing the drug, using the drug at a certain time. And you choose the time when your cells are in, of course, always harmony with the universe's cells. So when your cells are completely resting, but the cancer cells, they don't have any relationship. They've made this mistake of the intellect and gone on their own separate way. They don't behave cosmological rhythms. So they're always multiplying. They're crazy. It's the genius of the body that's gone mad. So you use your therapy in such a way that you hit those cells with the drug at a time when the rest of the body is in deep rest, because the body is behaving according to cosmological rhythms. Also, as the earth goes around the sun, there are cycles of the seasons. So if you fall in love in spring or get depressed in winter, it's because your biology is also changing with the seasons. And then these seasonal rhythms become very important. And we have all kinds of techniques to resynchronize our rhythms with the seasons through diet, through behavior, etc. Also, as the sun and the moon and the earth interact with each other, and the movements of this create the lunar month. Lunar month also has corresponding rhythms in our body. The sun's and the moon's gravitational effects on the earth cause the tides, and those have rhythms. We have tides in our body, ebb and flow, because the ocean inside us is identical to the ocean outside. In fact, we all came out of the same primordial soup anyway. So there's a similar ebb and flow here. Now you say, how can I keep track of all this? There's so many things. The answer is very simple. The universe sends you only two messages. One is a sense of comfort, the other is a sense of discomfort. When you're experiencing discomfort, whether it's emotional or psychological or physical, that is a reminder that your biological rhythms are not in tune with the cosmological rhythms. And therefore, if you just follow your own sense of comfort and discomfort, you'll discover these biological rhythms. Which means simply, when you really boil down to it, means eating when you're hungry, sleeping when you're sleepy, etc. That's half the story, yes. If you work the night shift, there's now a lot of evidence that that will disrupt your biological rhythms and weaken the immune system. And also the experience of jet lag is just a brief, but you know, you don't have it all the time. This is exactly what you do with night shifts also. It is not a healthy thing. What can I say? If you do it for several years, it definitely has an effect on the immune system and on the body's healing responses. Of course, it's always reversible. No matter how long you do it or how used to it you get, you're still not tuned in. This phenomenon is called entrainment. Have you heard the word entrainment? E-N-T-R-A-I-N-M-E-N-T. It means locking in. There's a physicist by the name of Itzhak Bentov who first described this. And what he did was a very elegant experiment. He took 10 clocks, you can do this experiment, 5 or 10 clocks, and you start the pendulum swinging at different times. Leave the room, come back after 4 hours, and you'll see that all the clocks after a while are now swinging to the same rhythm. They lock in with each other. If you have a lot of women in one environment, let's say convent or prison, same kind of if you have them all together, after a while you'll find that their menstrual cycles lock in with each other. They all have the same month, they have the same cycle. If you take a baby and you put it next to its mother's breast, you'll find that its heart rate soon establishes a rhythmic relationship with that of the mother. It may not be the exact same heart rate because the baby's heart rate is always faster, but there's a rhythmic relationship. There's a music to it. The baby's breathing will become synchronized with the mother's breathing. And in fact, the baby uses the mother to synchronize with the cosmic rhythm. Now, according to Vedic texts, this begins at the moment of conception. So it's very important for the mother to listen to have good experiences, listen to good music, have good sensory, full experience of sensory pleasures, and always in the direction of happiness. She hears, because now there's evidence, by the way, that the fetus can hear every single sound that is uttered. Every argument that you have, the fetus can hear. Even a minor thing like the door closing over there, instruments, sophisticated instruments show that the baby hears, and in fact encodes that sound. So this coding in begins right at the moment of conception and continues after birth. Now, you are familiar, I'm sure, with sudden infant death syndrome. It's also called crib death. I brought this to the attention. It's very common in some countries, like New Zealand. It's the number one cause of death in infants, crib death. And Australia also, it's very common. In this country, it's pretty common. And when I mentioned this to the Vedic doctors, they said, what do you call it? when I said crib death, she said, just get rid of the cribs. That was the insight. Because the baby uses the mother to lock into the rhythms. And it needs to be, that close proximity needs to be there. So this idea of entrainment or locking in is a very important idea now in biology, in chronotherapy. And you can use music for it. You can use sound for it. And it helps facilitate that locking in procedure. Okay, I think I should move on to something else. So let's go on to another sensory experience. Let's go to the experience of taste. And before we go into the experience of taste, I would like to mention some eating awareness techniques that are really emphasized in Ayurveda. You may be familiar with some of them, but I should emphasize them. In fact, that's half the story. If you're just practicing a little eating awareness, you will find that that gets rid of half the problems of weight control, indigestion, ulcers, and so forth. Eating awareness, following are simple things for eating awareness that you can do. Number one, whenever you eat, always sit down to eat. Never eat standing up or walking or driving, etc. Number two, doesn't matter how much you're going to eat, even if it's a scoop of ice cream or a peanut or any little bit, always sit down to eat. Number two, when you eat, don't do anything else, which includes not watching the television or reading a newspaper or listening to the radio. What about conversation? Because we say in Ayurveda, the expression is, it's the most creative act after thinking. They say when Brahman decided to manifest himself, first he had a thought and then he ate. So eating is a very important act here. It's how you convert one form of energy to another. It's a creative act and therefore you should enjoy it. So don't do anything else. What about conversation? Yes, you can have conversation, but only when the food is in your stomach and not in your mouth. So don't speak when the food is in the mouth. Now speak when the food is in the stomach. And listen when the food is in the mouth. It actually makes a good conversation. Everybody gets to speak and listen. Now if you don't believe, if this is not violated all the time, you just go to any restaurant and you'll see you can see the mush in people's mouths as speak and talk and eat at the same time. In children, we tell them, when we teach them eating awareness, we say, put down the fork in between bites. Once you've put down the fork, then speak all you want. Once you pick up the fork, then listen. It's fascinating with children. You do this for a few weeks, and you know, I've done it with my children. You ask them a question when the food is in their mouth, they cannot speak. It's impossible for them. They're so used to not doing it. So they'll nod, etc., agree, smile, but they won't say anything till the food goes down. But people do it all the time. In fact, this is what gives rise to gas and indigestion and ultimately ends up as all kinds of problems. And finally, be aware of your hunger level. In Ayurveda, we say that about 2 handfuls, like this, reaching up to here, 2 cupped handsful, is about the volume of food that will fill up 2/3 of your stomach, leaving 1/3 for digestion. And you shouldn't put food in your stomach if there's food from a previously digested meal still there. It should be empty. That usually takes about 4 hours. So one shouldn't even snack for 4 hours after a meal. And then after that, you can snack, of course. And when you eat, you should preferably eat on an empty stomach. Your level, your hunger level should be about 1, which means the stomach is completely empty. If you take 2 cupped handfuls, this will fill up 2/3 of your stomach. And if you follow eating awareness techniques, at that time you will feel satisfied. But usually what happens is there's memory And the memory says, I want more food. And if the memory says, I want more food, and the stomach says, no, I'm okay, then what you do is, you don't interfere with it, you just wait for 5 minutes. Before you go for your second helping, just wait for 5 minutes. Be non-judgmental about the whole thing. You say, I'll wait for 5 minutes and then I'll listen to whichever urge is stronger. In most cases, 80% of the time, after 5 minutes, the mind and the stomach will have be in agreement. You will lose the desire. If you don't lose the desire, then there is probably an underlying eating disorder. And that also, in Ayurveda we say, it is there because we have not trained ourselves to have access to sensory pleasure that comes from eating. That is because we have not accessed all the tastes. And these six tastes, if I can show you, there are six tastes that we talk about in Ayurveda. These are the six tastes. By the way, chicken, fish, etc., meats come in the first category because they have, by themselves, they have a sweet or sweet aftertaste. So, sugar, milk, butter, rice, bread, chicken, fish, etc., in the first category. Sour, yogurt, lemon, cheese, salt, you know what that is. Pungent is the taste of spicy foods. Peppers, ginger, cumin, paprika, all these ethnic foods, Chinese, Mexican, Indian, Italian, all have these spices. Bitter is the taste from spinach, green leafy vegetables, and also, you know, all the green leafies are bitter, asparagus, broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, etc. There's one particular food which is very bitter called bitter gourd, G-O-U-R-D, which you can get from Chinatown, and it's quite tasty, and it has a distinct bitter flavor to it. And the bitter taste actually is very good for diabetics. In fact, increases insulin secretion and is used for treating diabetes. And that particular food is very useful. And then the astringent taste is very peculiar to beans, lentils, and dals. Dals are certain kinds of lentil family. If you don't know what dal is, then next time you go to an Indian restaurant, ask for dal, you'll know what it is. Okay, so these are the six tastes, and if we don't have exposure to these six tastes, then we develop cravings. Now in our society, today, what are the three dominant tastes? Sweet, sour, and salt. French fries and ketchup. That has all the three tastes. Ketchup is a great example. It has sweet, sour, and salt. In fact, all the fast foods are sweet, sour, and salt. All the fast foods are sweet, sour, and salt. That's it, with the total exclusion of the others. So if you expose your taste buds to only those repeatedly, then because you develop nutritional cravings, you develop urges. But the memory is there only for sweet, sour, and salt. So what do? You end up having more sweet, sour, and salt. And that continually reinforces the experience of sweet, sour, and salt, more craving, because the body is craving for something it really needs. How do animals stay nutritionally secure? I mean, no animal has the faintest notion of what the U.S. Surgeon General said about the minimum requirement of calcium to prevent osteoporosis or something like that. But animals don't get nutritional deficiencies. It's only domesticated animals, Purina cat chow, and also zoos that you see deficiencies. And of course human beings, because we've made eating an intellectual thing. Ayurveda has said, go with the taste and enjoy the taste. So what we do is, with patients who have food cravings, they still have the urge, after waiting 5 minutes for the second helping, we then say, at least one meal a day, expose your taste buds to all the six different tastes. And these six different tastes, therefore one meal at least, should have some sweet, should have salt, should have sour, pungent, bitter. Also we find that the spices that I use, especially red peppers, black pepper, and all these pungent spices, ginger, cumin, there are lots of studies that show that they increase metabolic rate. In heavy people, there's a different set point. And those people, you've heard the expression, all I have to do is look at food and I gain weight. Well, these people have a different set point in their body to flavors. And if you just increase this last three foods in there, pungent, bitter, astringent, you'll find that their metabolic rate can be increased by as much as 25%. You can influence. You can't do that with thyroid hormone, but you can do it by adding a little spice to your food. That's why people very often sneeze and get red and break out into all kinds of sweats when they eat hot food. Now, one meal a day with all exposure to 6 days. In Ayurveda, we have also developed these herbal powders that are called churnas. And you can, if you don't have exposure to all the 6 days, you can just add the herbal powder. It will change your metabolism. So if you're the kind of person, for example, who says, all I have to do is look at food and gain weight, then there's a herbal powder called Kapha. K-A-P-H-A. And again, the number I gave you, they can supply that to you. Huh? 1-800 all Veda. Yeah.
Okay.
Same. Anyway, so Kapha will decrease, and there's a list of all these foods also, but we must proceed. So, no, it's all right. So, that kind of person would use spices, the last three tastes, astringent, bitter, pungent. If you are Vata type, which is the hyperactive person, who says, I can eat anything I want and I don't gain weight, then you need to use more sweet, sour, and salt, and so on. By and large, we trust our taste buds. We just eat what we enjoy the most, but make sure that you have access to all the different tastes. What about sweet category and sour category? They tend to produce mucus only in Kapha body types. In fact, yes, in Kapha body types, we tell them to decrease their intake of these and focus more on astringent, bitter, and pungent. So your body type determines. Not everybody will respond like that. And the other thing is a lot of this, what we have incriminated in milk products is not really because of milk, as all these problems with milk products. It's because milk is contaminated with antibiotics, with estrogens. You know, they feed all the stuff to the cattle. But now you can get milk that is not from such sources, and you should look for that. Also, meat, chicken and fish, is contaminated with hormones, with antibiotics. But there are sources now, you can get chicken, which is not contaminated, which is brought up, you know, in farms that don't use artificial things to bring up these animals. Is there a text? Well, there's a book coming out that I've written. It's called Perfect Health, Mind, Practical Mind-Body Guide.
Are you going to discuss
Dr. Roy Walford is the world's expert, at least in modern science, on the relationship of the amount of food that we take and lifespan. He's written a fascinating book, if you want to read it. It's called Maximum Lifespan. And it's available in all the bookstores. Dr. Walford is professor of nutrition and geriatrics at UCLA. And Dr. Walford is also actually a closet yogi. He spends half the time in half his life. He spends in India. And he has done the most fascinating work on the relationship of nutrition and aging. His initial work is in animals, and he coined the term, which has become very popular in medicine these days, called undernutrition. It's a misnomer, really. What he's talking about is hopefully normal nutrition. But what he finds is that if you give animals access to unlimited food, let's say you have a pet, and you have access to, or even if you have a bird feeder outside your garden, okay, and you give animals access to unlimited food, they'll start eating after a while more than they need. But animals in the wild don't do that. They follow only internal cues. They don't follow external cues. We follow external cues, particularly as a result of media, industry, television, menus, etc. Now, animals in the wild will follow only internal cues. But if you bring them up in a laboratory, where you expose them to unlimited amount of food or pets, then they start following external cues and they start overeating. He cuts down their intake progressively by 75% over a period of time. And he has shown that in mice, in this particular group of mice, you can extend the lifespan of mice 5 times just by cutting down the amount of food that they eat. He has the equivalent of 80-year-old female mice, in human terms, giving birth to babies. He's the first one to prove that you can reverse reproductive abilities by cutting down on nutritional intake in animals. This is an astounding and remarkable study. These menopausal mice restore fertility just by cutting down their nutritional intake. So in general, the feeling is creeping in Western medicine also, that we eat too much. And as a result of external cues, in fact, we accelerate the aging process by eating too much. And therefore, the Ayurvedic tenet of fasting has many, many useful applications. It is recommended that if you are a kapha body type, the heavy type, slow metabolizer, then you should fast at least once a week, which means for one day, just take fruit juice and nothing else, or vegetable juice. And if you're a pitta body type, which is more mesomorphic type, like me for example, then once a month or twice a month. And if you're a vata body type, which is hypermetabolic, thin, wiry, tense, then probably don't do it till you see your doctor. Ask his advice. So, yes, fasting plays a useful role. And the amount. That's why this Ayurvedic idea of eating just this much is a very good idea if you can do it. Don't have to finish everything on your plate. In fact, don't even take everything. But if you do, then don't worry. The kids in China or Bangladesh are not going to be helped if you finish everything on your plate. And that's something that we were brainwashed into thinking. Yes. Yeah. The question is, how can we use the mind to influence the body? By listening. Your body gives out messages all the time. Now, let's say, and this is what we're doing. We're asking the body, how much do you want to eat? Okay? And after a certain while, it says, that's enough. But we usually don't listen because we don't give it time. So that's what I'm saying. Also, next time, do this very interesting experiment. Go to a restaurant and look at the menu and don't decide by using your mind what you're going to have. Look at the menu and ask your stomach, would you like this, would you like this, would you like this? Put your hand here and ask your stomach. You'll see. The stomach will give you very good information. If it wants something, it will give you a tug. If it doesn't want it, it will require. Now, this technique can be used for many things, including cutting down on smoking, decreasing coffee consumption, etc. What happens is people, let's say they like to drink coffee. You ask them, do you enjoy it? They say, I love the first cup. It smells good, it tastes good, etc. Second cup, I'm not so sure. And after that, I feel sick, but I drink it anyway. That's what they do. Now, we tell them, every time you pass by the coffee pot at work, and you have that urge, just put your hand over your stomach and ask your stomach, do you want this? And after the second cup, you'll feel the recoil of your stomach. It will recoil, it will not. If you just listen, then spontaneously you'll see that the body's inner intelligence, which is the ultimate and supreme genius, and mirrors the wisdom of the universe, will begin to tell you what to do. Also in smokers, if you want to give up smoking, the worst thing you can do is to try to give it up. Never works. So you tell people, okay, if you want to give up smoking, then what you do is you bring it into an act of conscious awareness. So every time you have the urge to smoke, go sit outside by yourself with some fresh air, and then don't do anything else. Don't watch television, don't read the book. People usually have these cues. They pick up a cup of coffee and light up a cigarette at the same time. They watch television, light up a cigarette, or they drink telephone, they light up a cigarette. So you dissociate it from all those. You bring it into conscious awareness. Before you start smoking, before you light it up, ask your lungs, do you really want this? Don't be judgmental, and you'll see that the lungs will give a little wheeze usually and recoil. You'll see that. Despite that, you may decide to go ahead and smoke because you have a strong urge. Fine, go ahead and smoke. But as you are smoking, just again, ask your lungs, how do you feel? And be aware of the sensations. Don't be judgmental about yourself. Don't be judgmental about the act. Just be aware of it. And slowly you'll find that the lungs will begin to reject because you've given some time to listen. And that's true of any organ in the body. I'll proceed now to something else. Since we've covered sound, sight, taste, let's just touch on touch for a moment. This morning we were talking about tactile kinesthetic stimulation and how the experience of touch can actually cause a weight gain of 49% per day. Now, we find that in fact our skin is the most important organ for the secretion of hormones as well as the secretion of the immune cells. When I was in medical school, we had this idea that there's a pituitary gland and hypothalamus and adrenals and thyroid. These are all the various sources of hormones. That's true, but the biggest source of hormones is your skin and mucous membranes. The skin is the biggest factory of hormones. All the hormones like ACTH, tumor necrosis factor, which is a very powerful anti-cancer drug, interleukins, which are also powerful anti-cancer drugs, interferons, which are very powerful anti-cancer drugs, are processed, of course, in the brain, but also in large amounts in the skin. So the skin is the biggest source of hormones. Also, the skin is the biggest source of immune cells, T cells, B cells, which get manufactured in the thymus and the bone marrow, ultimately get processed into their active forms in the skin. So this is the reason why touch and massage and experience of touch actually has a healing effect. You're familiar with therapeutic touch, I'm sure, and all the techniques of therapeutic touch. However, in Ayurveda, we say there's a minimal sensory daily dose of touch. And therefore, you should have a massage every day. Every day. And if you can give it to yourself, that's also very convenient. So, of course, in our clinics, we give people very intense Ayurvedic massage, and there's all kinds of techniques for massage. And there are points in the body called marma points. One of them is here, another is on the soles of the foot. The soles of the foot, interestingly, is a very interesting place to massage. When you vigorously massage the soles of the foot, you elicit a certain response from the body. It immediately puts people to sleep, especially if you use warm sesame oil. And with children, it's amazing. While you're doing it, they fall asleep. We've demonstrated this on television even. A child is there, cranky and crying, and you start massaging the soles of the feet with warm sesame oil, and they go off to sleep while you're doing the massage. And then there's another point here which elicits again brainwave coherence. But we recommend a daily warm sesame oil massage before the shower. It takes about 5 minutes. Start with the head, the whole body, long bones, strokes like this, and then over the joints, circular motions. You cover the whole body quickly with warm sesame oil and then shower. If you have some problem like dandruff or athlete's foot, just use a little warm sesame oil before you shower every day, and that will take care of dandruff and athlete's foot forever. Also, if you swish a little bit of the sesame oil in your oral cavities after you brush your teeth, swish it around a little bit, and then you can, you know, throw it out. And this is very good for the gums. And people who practice this regularly do not have dental caries. I'm proud to say I don't have a single cavity so far. And so the sesame oil stimulates immune system and is part of our healing program. All the five senses are used. And finally, smell. You know, smell is a very powerful immunomodulator also, because smell is linked to emotions. Perfume industry has really capitalized on this. And, you know, smells can evoke very powerful memories. You have to smell a certain bread and you remember your childhood. You remember a certain smell of a certain food. You can go back years and years. Smells are very strongly encoded in as cellular memories. In fact, fish, when they reproduce, they come back to their spawning grounds as a result of the memory of smell. In California, they've made a big industry out of this. What they do is they take young salmon as they hatch, and they just impregnate the pool where they're hatching with a little smell, artificial smell, whatever. And then they let the fish out into the sea, these little fish that are about this big. And then 10 years later, they're this big, and they're ready to spawn. They remember the smell and come back to the exact pool where they were spawned from. They've been all over the world, Pacific, Australia, everywhere. But the memory of smell will bring them back to their birthplace. Now, when a mother gives birth to a baby, that smell of the baby is encoded in the mother's in the mother's consciousness within 2 hours. A mother will never forget. I'm talking about human mothers, but also about any other species, wild beasts, for example. They'll be in big herds, thousands of wild beasts together. But the mother will be able to find her baby, her little calf, through smell. They all look the same, little calf, hundreds of thousands in the herd, through smell. So smells are very strong influences on physiological processes, and the most of them are beneath our level of conscious awareness. We're not even aware of them. And yet, our interaction with each other, our reaction to each other, our ability to relate to each other, our responses to each other, our behavioral responses, are at subtle levels influenced by smell below the threshold of our conscious awareness. In Ayurveda, the smells are used for healing according to body types again. If you're a slow metabolizer, if you tend to be lazy and you need to perk yourself up a little bit, a stimulating smell is eucalyptus. If you tend to get angry and impatient and have a pitta, fiery temperament, then sandalwood is a good smell for you. If you're a hyperactive, hypermetabolic type, then the smell of basil is more appropriate to decrease the metabolism. And smells are used for influencing metabolism, again according to vata, pitta, kapha, these different psychophysiological body types. For those of you who heard the question, positive attitudes mean good health. And yet we see people with positive attitudes that do not get better. Well, first of all, I don't want to give the impression that attitude is the most important thing. The most important thing is witnessing. The most important thing is being a silent witness, which has nothing to do with attitude. It's the experience of silence, the gap between thoughts, that is more important than the attitude. I said the ability to think is a powerful one. The ability not to think is even more powerful. And when you stop experiencing a lot of noise and you have this inner silence, that is the key to healing. The healing occurs in the gap between thoughts. Our life, our inner dialogue is always definitions, labels, descriptions, interpretations, evaluations, analyses, judgments. Can you suspend judgment for the next 1 hour? Do it and you'll know what silence is. Of course, again, the most basic technique is to actually transcend all that. But it is a good exercise to be non-evaluative for certain moments of your life, and then you will experience silence. In the silence is the healing. The other thing that we do as part of our, with some patients, is we have them practice silence for extended periods of time. So we can start off with 24 hours, no talking. They just go wearing a button which says, I'm in silence, I will not converse, etc., while they're in the clinic. Amazing things happen. You know, in the first 24 hours they begin to unstress, they get very stressful, emotional, crying, etc., etc. They have a turbulence of emotions. And then as 24 hours go by, they begin to settle down. In 3 or 4 days, they start experiencing inner silence. And particularly if they're meditating twice a day, it becomes an exquisite experience. When you have inner silence and you're going around, then everything becomes vibrant and alive. And here, then, the healing is much more powerful. Much more powerful. Here, a thought is much more powerful because it's coming from the depth of the ocean of consciousness. Now, you'll say, yes, but still people do get sick and still people do die. Well, that's true. I mean, we are the metabolic end products of all our sensory experiences, plus the entire evolutionary history of mankind, plus the collective consciousness of our society at the moment. There's so many factors. That doesn't mean that the techniques are not effective. People die in Harvard Medical School every day. Okay, which doesn't mean that everything that they do is useless. They do some very useful things. Okay, let me talk about biological aging. And I'd like to first of all list all the factors that we know now that influence age and some of the recent studies that have been done. And the first one here, which is probably the most important one, is premature cognitive commitments, individual and collective mindset. Let me explain that a little bit. About 15, 20 years ago, Dr. Alexander Leaf, who was then professor of medicine at Harvard and who was retiring, he was in his 60s, decided to go around the world and study aging populations, or populations where aging is apparently a different phenomenon. And although in some of these countries, the infant mortality is high because of poor hygiene, poor socio-economic conditions, once people go beyond infancy, they live very long. And he found in a number of parts of the world a lot of centenarians, particularly in the Hindu Kush Mountains, in Himalayas, in parts of Afghanistan, in the Soviet state of Georgia, and in the southern Andes, there are a number of centenarians. He brought back fantastic pictures with him. I remember afterwards in the 1970s attending a conference at Harvard Medical School where he showed these pictures of 110-year-old people on horseback, some of them even smoking cigarettes, and other 100-year-old centenarians running into streams of icy water in snow-clad mountains. Healthy-looking centenarians. And what Dr. Leaf came back with the impression, and this was the first of a series of epidemiological studies, was that in these societies, to grow older was regarded by society to get better. The older you got, the more you were the envy of everybody in society, because you were wiser, you were more useful, they gave you more responsibility, and they felt that you were in fact the foundation of society. And literally, young people envied older people and regarded them with reverence and regarded them as the source of wisdom. As a result, that collective expectation translated into a different biology of these people. This is the first good study. Then there were some American physiologists who went to the southern Andes, where there's a tribe of Indians called the Tarahumara Indians. If you haven't heard about them, that's the most amazing story of all time. Here, they have a tradition, it's dying out now, unfortunately. The Tarahumara Indians are also drinking Budweiser beer and watching television. But here there was a tradition where one chief communicated with another chief, not through telephone, but through messenger runners. And the collective expectation in this society is that the older you get, the better you are at running. Now that's a very interesting collective expectation. So what happened? Well, the 30-year-olds are better than the 20-year-olds. The 40-year-olds are better runners than the 30-year-olds. And the 60-year-olds are the best. And then also they plateau out. The other thing is, they don't have any of the physiological expressions of aging that we normally associate with aging. Their blood pressures get lower as they grow older. Their hearing improves as they get older. Now, you would say that if I found one person like that in the whole universe, I would just take that person and want to know everything about him. Well, the study is published. It broke everybody's conceptual framework. All the physiologists said, wow, what a great study, and then they forgot about it. Which is such a tragedy, because this great example is enough to completely break our conceptions of what aging is supposed to mean in physiological terms. Well, more recently, Dr. Ellen Langer, who's a psychologist at Harvard, she's a professor, full tenured professor at Harvard, who's also very expert in this whole idea. Her whole life has been dedicated to what she calls mindsets and expectations, mindfulness and mindlessness, etc. She has coined some very fabulous terms in psychology. And in fact, this term premature cognitive commitment is her coined term. In Ayurveda, we call a premature cognitive commitment a boundary. And we call the breaking down of these premature cognitive commitments as boundary breaking, till you're left with just the boundless. When Maharshi was asked, what's the definition of a boundary? He said, it's a wave of the boundless. So even in a particle, you see the whole universe, basically. But in any case, what Ellen Langer did in 1985, she advertised in the Boston Globe for 100 people that were over the age of 70 that she would take out of Boston to some place outside in a old monastery for an experiment. What's the experiment? She said, for 10 days we're going to pretend. And what are we going to pretend? We are going to pretend that it is 30 years ago. All the people must be over 70 years old, and for the next 10 days we're going to pretend that it's 30 years ago. We're living in the 50s. The war is over, and all the newspapers, she had Life magazine apparently, it was very popular then. She had the place flooded with Life magazines and pictures and postcards and posters, music from the 50s, newspaper items from the 50s. And fashions from the 50s, everything from the 50s. And we are going to talk in the present tense about that time. In another part of the monastery, she has another group of 100 people over 70. They're also talking about the 50s. But they're talking about the 50s in the past tense. They're also also thinking, putting their attention. The only difference is this group is talking about the 50s and living it out in the present tense. The other group is thinking about it and talking about it in the past tense. Well, after 3 days, she took some photographs. That was the first inkling that something was happening, because she showed these photographs to independent observers and said, now, who's younger? And they said, when was this photograph taken? And most everybody said, this photograph is from 10 years ago, or from, you know, this person is 10 years younger than this person. Well, then she really got into it. She started measuring hearing thresholds, vision, systolic blood pressure. There's a very complex hormone in the blood called dehydroepiandrosterone sulfate, DHEA sulfate. It's an adrenal hormone that as people get older, it normally goes down. Started going up in these people. She ended up measuring 100 different biological parameters of aging, including immune responses, endocrine responses, and all of them had reversed by at least 20 years in less than 10 days. She reversed their biological ages by over 20 years in 10 days. Brought them back to Boston Friday evening. By Monday morning, they were back where they had started from. So she was asked, can't we, you know, have some Shangri-La, some place where we can do this forever? And her response is, society will not let you. There are too many reminders all the time in our society of what a certain age is supposed to mean. So behave yourself, be your age. What do you expect at my age, etc., etc. You know, we have these premature cognitive commitments about aging in our society. Men get naughty at 40. Some women have menopause a little bit later. People get into nursing homes at such and such age. Retirement is at such and such age, etc., etc. These are premature commitments about what a certain biological response is supposed to mean. And they're part of our collective consciousness, part of our global mind. You can't escape it. Of course, you can escape it if you go to a cave in the Himalayas and completely... Even then, on quantum mechanical levels, you can't totally escape it, but you can escape it to quite a great degree. So, we're not about to do that. What to do? It's the collective mindset, the paradigm of the age that influences local or biological expression of aging, even in an individual. And Ellen Langer from Harvard says, society will not let you. Adi Shankara, who's hundreds of years ago, a great Vedic seer, said something even more beautiful. He said, the only reason people grow old and die is that they see other people growing old and dying. And then he said, what we see, we become. Of course, this is the same thing, well, now we can say in very refined, sophisticated, physiological terms, we can say we are the metabolic end products of our sensory experiences and how we interpret those sensory experiences. It's exactly the same thing Adi Shankara was saying. He said, the only reason people become old and die is to see other people doing the same thing. And we become what we see. So, I think the paradigm shift is very important. It's the most crucial element of our age is that the global mind itself has to change its perception of reality. And then reality will change. In the Vedic tradition, we have four periods that cycles that go, that the universe goes through. From complete ignorance to complete enlightenment, and during these cycles, biological expressions also change. Aging is influenced. I'm going to quickly go over the rest of these. Exercise, important function of biological expression. But don't have the idea that if something is good for you, more of it is better, necessarily. The entire fitness craze that swept this country is now being questioned. In fact, there is no correlation between conditioning and aging. In fact, if you look at all the data, particularly from East Germany, it turns out that Olympic athletes don't live as long as normal control populations. Athletes in general don't live as long as normal control populations. Over-conditioning leads to things like cardiomyopathy, hypertension, kidney hemorrhages, uterine fibroids, many, many things. In fact, I'm told the Surgeon General is going to issue another warning. Jogging may be hazardous to your health. What is the best form of exercise? According to Vedic prescriptions, and by the way, from most of the exercise physiology labs now, exercise should be moderate, should be regular, and should be enjoyable. If you don't enjoy it, then doing it actually may harm you. So the best exercises, they say, are brisk walking, and it should be comfortable and enjoyable, which means you should be able to carry on a conversation, not get short of breath or break out into a sweat. Or swimming, or yoga. And also, if you don't do all of that, then just be sensible about your daily activities. I mean, I know people who will drive around for 2 hours, finally park in the handicap zone because they can be near their aerobic center. Now, so park the car at a distance from where you're going to go. Use the stairs instead of taking the elevator. If you want to talk to your husband or wife in the other room, instead of screaming from this room, go to the other room and talk to them. We have a rule in our house, nobody can scream at anybody else. You want to speak, if a phone is picked up by my son in another room, he'll pick up the phone and he'll say, hold on, and he'll come to my room and say, there's a phone call for you. So, go to the other room and talk to the person instead of scream. Do just these little things, and in fact, you will expend as much energy in exercise that you need to. Just forget using elevators, park the car at a distance from where you are going, and use every opportunity to exercise, whether it's in the garden, picking up the luggage, etc. Every of those opportunities, if you use, you'll expend a lot of useful energy. Okay, so let me move on. I think we've addressed nutrition. One point that I did not address in nutrition is that about 80% of our body is water.